Welcome to the CSIS Cogit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. In Seoul on March 21st, the foreign ministers of China, Japan and South Korea met for the first time in 3 years for trilateral diplomatic talks. While the countries pledged to coordinate policy on a range of issues, including counter-terrorism and North Korea's denuclearization, tensions between each of the parties over territorial disputes, economic competition, and historical issues remain. The ministers pledged to hold a leaders' summit at the earliest convenient time for the three countries. Singapore began a period of introspection and remembrance this week, following the death of former Prime Minister Lee Kuan Yew. Tributes and obituaries for Singapore's Grand Master came from around the globe, while outside the National Parliament, where Lee's body lies in state, lines extended for several miles as Singaporeans waited to pay their respects. India's Supreme Court reached a watershed decision on March 24th to strike down a provision in the government's cyber law. The law permitted the arrest of individuals for allegedly posting offensive content online. Supporters hailed the judgment as protecting freedom of expression guaranteed by the Indian Constitution. The decision was taken on a case that was filed in November 2012 after two women were arrested, one for posting a comment on Facebook criticising a citywide shutdown in Mumbai during the funeral of a prominent official, the other for liking the comment. In regional economic news, the Asian Development Bank released their annual signature forecasting analysis, the Asian Development Outlook 2015. This edition is bullish, expecting Asia to grow at 6.3% in 2015 and 2016. ADB analysts are projecting a 7.2% growth rate for China's economy this year, 0.4 percentage points above the IMF's own estimates gauging China's economic slowdown. A large part of the strong regional assessment is the ADB's projection for India, where they're expecting growth to expand to 7.8% in 2015 and 8.2% the following year. And that's the news. We now turn to the region's major story this week, the passing of Singapore's Lee Kuan Yew. Lee, the first Prime Minister of Singapore, served for three decades and presided over a remarkable transformation in the small nation's fortunes. I sat down with my CSIS colleague Murray Hebert, Senior Fellow with the Sumitro Chair in Southeast Asia Studies, to discuss Lee's legacy and his impact on Singapore. So this week we witnessed the passing of Lee Kuan Yew, the founding father of Singapore. What's going to be his lasting impact on the country and the region?
Well, one thing for sure, he took that country up by the bootstraps, and with implementing a rule of law and dealing with corruption issues, he managed to pull that country up from about $500 per capita per year to the point now, when he dies, it is over $50,000 a year. That's a massive increase in 4 or 5 decades. Really focused on economic development, attracting foreign investors. He turned it into an oil refinery place, chemical production. They have a very good natural port, which is always one of the top ports in Asia, competing with Shanghai or Hong Kong. He instituted a rural Kampong kind of place back in when he took over, but it's now a very modern, gleaming city, very clean, very efficient. And he provided housing for people, provided retirement. He was not a nanny state, that's for sure. He built government housing, but sold it to the people, gave them a retirement policy that's not like. It's very much you set up a fund that you pay into, which has been very effective in improving people's livelihood. But of course, not everybody quite made it. You know, about 10% of the population is still relatively poor.
And with his son now Prime Minister, are we to see more of the same from Singapore, or is there a chance for maybe a little more diversity maybe in the political scene?
Well, certainly, I think we're going to see a lot of the similar economic policies. It's a bit difficult for Singapore right now. There's an economic slowdown in China and parts of the Asian region. And so Singapore, as growth has slowed, and it has to figure out, it's looking for trying to boost efficiency and these kinds of things. It also struggles with the problem of only having 5.5 million people. If it wants to attract investors like Hewlett-Packard and bring in banks like JP Morgan and Citi, they have a lack, they don't have enough workers, and so they have brought in a lot of workers, beginning under Lee Kuan Yew, but also under his son. That has caused some anxiety domestically of the large number of foreigners who didn't grow up there, don't have the same cultural perspectives. But I think generally you're going to see a pro-business environment for sure. We've already seen in 2011, after an election, the ruling People's Action Party, which was founded by Lee Kuan Yew and his colleagues, they did a little worse. They only won 60% of the popular vote, but lost 6 seats in the parliament, the largest number they'd ever lost. And they viewed it as really quite a loss. And so they have taken steps to try to address some of the issues that people have, such as the issue of so many foreign immigrants. So they're going to cut down on the numbers, they admit. They also are going to address the rising cost of housing, which has really skyrocketed as a result of so many people moving in so quickly. I think socially, we've seen a little more space in the blogosphere. That in people commenting, criticizing. I think you can expect that over the years you're going to have a little more leeway in the political space to make criticism. The opposition did relatively well in 2011 because they're getting better, stronger candidates to run, former bankers, very high profile people, not just sort of dissident types. You know, we'll have to see. The Prime Minister Lee went after somebody just earlier this year for contempt of court for criticisms. Whether they will relax, they won't relax as much maybe as some people would hope, but I think we're going to see a more relaxed place.
And culturally speaking, I mean, you hear the stereotypes of a very harsh rule of law, even on small things. Do you think with his passing there's going to be things will become a little more lax, or is that now completely ingrained?
Well, you know, Lee did some amazing Lee Kuan Yew did some amazing things. Banned chewing gum. They put up signs in malls and in places to please flush the toilet. Put in signs, don't urinate in elevators. He was trying to teach people how you behave in a very crowded environment. I still think, chewing gum under the free trade agreement with the United States is legalized to some extent. You can get it if your doctor says you need it. You can buy it from a pharmacy, but you cannot buy it in the grocery store or your equivalent of a drugstore or whatever. I think they'll give the press really hasn't opened up very much. I was a journalist in Singapore in the 90s, and I came there after a period when the magazine I worked for, the Far Eastern Economic Review, was banned. I was asked to go. I knew it was a bit difficult. I did a story on how Singapore was reconstructing some of its old buildings, doing a much better job than some of its neighbors who were knocking them all down. However, in the end, the government was not pleased with my story, and I was banned then from talking to officials for 6 months. And then they relaxed, and it isn't quite that strict anymore, but it's not the easiest. It's a good place to report on the region. It's difficult for a journalist to write about Singapore itself.
And building on that, on a broader sense about Singapore as a whole, Lee Kuan Yew is credited for obviously their huge success. But of course, without the Singaporean people, none of this would have happened. And a big focus was on education and bringing a higher standard of living to Singapore through that. Is there something that maybe emerging economies in the region could learn from these strategies now? That's something that they could take as they're trying to progress?
Well, it's obvious that Singapore does have a model. However, it is a city. At the time he took over, it was about 2.5 million people. So that's a little different than a country like China or India that have such giant populations. However, he did some things that were really helpful. One, he took on corruption head on, very sharp penalties for being caught with corruption. He introduced rule of law. And like you said, he really tried to ramp up the Singapore education system to the point where they have one of the best math curriculums in the world, and there are schools in the United States that now use Singapore curriculum, including in neighboring suburbs of Washington. So he created an atmosphere that was very conducive to doing business. And I think a lot of countries could learn in the ease of doing business index that the World Bank puts out every year. Singapore is always one or two. That's a very efficient port, very efficient banking system. And it's so foreign companies really do like to operate there. It's a major hub. It's the smallest country Brunei is smaller, but it's one of the smallest countries in Southeast Asia. It still has the largest U.S. investment of any country in the region. U.S. companies have been big in financial services, in pharmaceuticals, and in a lot of sectors. It's too expensive now to manufacture electronics, but it does still produce some component parts. But it is really a model that people countries can look to what you've got to do, what it is that foreign companies want. They want rule of law, educated workers. They want a clean environment. They also want a safe place for their families to live. So Singapore met the bill on those issues.
That was Murray Hebert. Now on to our leaderboard. This week we profile Bambang Brojonegoro of Indonesia. Bambang has been the finance minister of Indonesia since October 2014. He was appointed vice minister of finance during the administration of former president Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. Before entering government in 2011, Bambang served as a director at the Islamic Development Bank and as dean of faculty in the economics department at Universitas Indonesia. He holds a master's degree in urban planning and a PhD in regional planning from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Bambang recently played a crucial role in drafting the revised 2015 national budget that was passed by the opposition-controlled lower house of Indonesia's parliament in February. The revised budget marks President Jokowi Widodo's second major economic victory since taking office, following his decision last year to cut Indonesia's costly fuel subsidies. The new budget transfers the savings from Indonesia's reduced fuel subsidies to new infrastructure spending, which economists agree is crucial to helping Indonesia maintain an annual growth rate above 6%. Bambang said he will direct the new spending towards agricultural irrigation, roads in rural areas, and seaports. Infrastructure upgrades lie at the heart of Jokowi's efforts to promote Indonesia as open for business and investment. Down the road, in addition to supervising infrastructure spending, Dr. Bambang is expected to tackle tax reforms in Indonesia. These reforms will likely consist of shifting the tax burden from businesses, which account for most government revenue, to individuals and offering tax incentives to companies that invest in key sectors of the economy. Bambang has pointed out that Indonesia's current tax base is around 12% of its gross domestic product, which is small for a country of its size. And now on to our one to watch. FIFA, the global football organization, has announced this week that bidding to host the 2026 World Cup will conclude in 2017. With Russia hosting in 2018 and Qatar winning the rights for 2022, speculation has already begun about the next round of bids, despite extensive corruption allegations and controversies surrounding the selection process. Given President Xi Jinping's well-known love of the beautiful game and publicly stated desire to host, China would seem a likely entrant. Northeast Asia has hosted the tournament only once, when South Korea and Japan co-hosted in 2002. The problem is the level of performance of China's team. 2002, coincidentally, was the only time in the last 30 years that China's team qualified. In contrast to the success of their women's team, China's men are known for their mediocrity, along with embarrassing disorganization in China's National Super League, known as much for its off-field corruption and dysfunction than anything else. While China's State Council has initiated a new plan to make soccer part of the national school curriculum at the primary level, the men's team languished as low as 97th in the world rankings last year. Yet a glimmer of success at this year's Asian Cup in Australia, where Team Dragon qualified for the quarterfinals, has fans dreaming big. Typically, FIFA World Cup bids rotate across the various continental federations. But given the marketing opportunity to sell the game to a population of 1.4 billion, one expects FIFA would welcome a bid from Beijing. That's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitata.com and csis.org. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.